This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. We are undoubtedly aware of the crisis facing our planet due to the changing climate, and in news coverage of the danger, we often read, watch, or listen to reports about fossil fuels and industry pollution. But a new book spells out how you can fight back against climate change from your own kitchen. Author Paul Greenberg, who previously wrote the New York Times bestseller Four Fish, is out with a new title, The Climate Diet: 50 Simple Ways to Trim Your Carbon Footprint. Paul Greenberg joins us now on the phone. Paul, thank you for spending some time with us.
Oh, my pleasure, Michael. Thank you.
Well, these are very simple ways, as suggested in your book. I'm wondering, you know, a lot of us are conscious of climate change and little ways that we might be able to contribute. But do you think there's a way or a couple of ways in this book that might be most surprising to people who are even aware of the situation?
Well, I think, you know, there's a lot of people, I think, when we talk about diet, are aware that beef, for example, is a serious problem in terms of emissions. Something like, you know, 27 kilograms of carbon emissions per kilogram of beef that you eat, compared to like a lentil, which is like, I don't know, 0.9, I think, kilograms of carbon dioxide per kilogram of lentil that you eat. And people get hung up on, well, I just need to quit beef, but they don't. And they think they need to go vegetarian, or they think they need to go vegan. But there are changes you can make to your diet that actually cut your carbon dioxide emissions quite a bit, like going from beef to chicken, for example. Chicken is only like less than 7 kilos of carbon dioxide per kilo of meat that you eat. So you can already cut your CO2 impact by three-quarters, at least in your diet, if you make the simple switch from beef to chicken. Cheese, for example, though, is not such a great choice. Cheese is actually only half of the amount of emissions as beef. So, you know, there are little things that you can do along the way that I map out in the book that help guide you to make the right choice instead of the sort of knee-jerk choice that you might have been misinformed to make.
So when we think about beef and cheese, we're thinking about some pretty serious staples of the American diet. So how do you go about talking to people who would just shudder at the thought of reducing the amount of cheeseburgers they might eat, for example?
Well, I am vegan mostly, and it was a little tricky to do at first. But I think that rather than just sort of saying, you know, oh, no, I'm never going to have a cheeseburger ever again, I think you could think about seriously reducing the overall kilos or pounds of meat that you eat per month. So just by cutting back a couple of meals a week would be a pretty significant reduction in your emissions. So you could start with that. I also think that, you know, you can find pleasure in other foods, but it just requires, you know, just a little bit of tweaking and changing of habits. You know, we already do eat quite a bit. We actually eat more chicken than beef as a country overall. So eating a little more chicken and a little less beef actually would start to point us in the right direction.
We're talking with Paul Greenberg. He's the author of the new book, The Climate Diet: 50 Simple Ways to Trim Your Carbon Footprint. One thing that surprised me among your simple suggestions is related to frozen foods. And I know any of us who are familiar with like dieting and trying to eat natural or raw, they tell you to stay away from frozen foods because of preservatives and that sort of thing. But the way you frame it is related to the way such foods are transported and stored, right?
That's right. So the corollary to avoiding or to favoring frozen foods is to avoid flying food. So fresh fish, fresh berries out of season, things like that tend to get flown to us, and that has just a huge carbon impact. Something like 10 or 20 times, it depends on the exact method, than if you send something by ship. So when you take, say, example, Alaska salmon, right, if you were to get that fresh in season, and by the way, it's really only in season fresh, maybe June, July, August kind of thing, but if you're getting that fresh, it would have to be flown to you, and that would be super, super expensive from a carbon standpoint. But, and I've spent a lot of time with Alaska fisheries, they do flash freeze those salmon, really, really high quality freezing process, no preservatives, send it to you by ship. And it's a fraction of the carbon footprint. So choosing frozen a lot of times can be a really good choice. Another kind of funny thing that I think is always strange, I always see this a lot in supermarkets, is you'll see you'll see on the fresh counter Alaska salmon in the middle of January. Well, chances are that was actually already frozen and then defrosted and put out on the shelf there. So you'd better just go to the frozen counter and you'll save yourself a lot of food quality, but also you'll end up with a better carbon footprint overall.
We also focus a lot these days on farmers markets and buying from local farmers, local produce, and that sort of thing. But you suggest we need to be thoughtful with that. Can you explain?
We do. Well, first of all, I mean, driving all the way to the farmer's market to buy one head of broccoli, already you've gotten yourself into some carbon trouble because, as I point out in the book, and the book isn't just about diet, it's really about your whole lifestyle. Driving is actually America's number one problem when it comes to carbon emissions. So just shooting down to the farmer's market in a car, buying a head of broccoli is pretty, pretty wasteful. But the other larger point is that you have to be careful about what you're buying from the market as relates to particular seasons. So, you know, in the middle of winter or in the early spring, you'll find greens that are grown using greenhouses and so forth that have external heat added to the greenhouse. That's going to actually increase the carbon footprint. So in wintertime, if you desperately really want a salad, it actually turns out to be more carbon efficient to buy from a more favorable climate, say California, where those greens are grown without added energy put into a greenhouse situation. So, you know, if you're in the Northeast or if you're in a northern climate and it's still quite cold out and you want to eat climate friendly, choose something like cabbage, which is actually very cold tolerant. So just be thoughtful. Just because it comes from the farmer's market doesn't necessarily mean it's a carbon efficient way to eat.
One part of the book that made me feel quite guilty is related to packaging. And I think, you know, maybe single guys like me are buying things packaged because it's easier to do and it doesn't take so much time. But packaging is a very serious situation related to our carbon footprint. And you suggest we should be buying our food naked.
Yeah, I mean, it's about 5% of food's carbon footprint. It's not as huge a choice as, say, choosing a lentil over a piece of beef, but it's significant. And overall, we also have a huge problem with plastic waste in our oceans, as I'm sure you've reported on before. I personally try to buy fruits and vegetables without using that bag, for example, when I go to the produce counter. I look for minimal packaging whenever possible. Bringing your own packaging is pretty good thing to do. I mean, bringing your own bags, recyclable bags. I just think that a lot of times packaging is created to take up shelf space and to catch your eye. And if your eye is really on the real prize, which is lowering your carbon footprint, then you'll try to avoid packaging as much as possible.
And this is a reason you suggest we should be drinking water from the tap as well.
Absolutely. Well, that's the biggest elephant in the room when it comes to packaging. I mean, I think we Americans drink something like 40 gallons of bottled water each and every year, and yet 90% of us or more have access to perfectly clean, potable, delicious tap water. So, trying to avoid that on a regular basis. I mean, I don't know about you, but I grew up in an era where there was no bottled water, and we did fine. We didn't really need to have it. This is just another way for industries to try to sell us something that we don't need. So, I think as an individual, as a nation, if we could wean ourselves off of bottled water, that would do a huge amount of savings, both for plastic waste, but also for our carbon footprint.
We're talking with Paul Greenberg. His new book is The Climate Diet, 50 Simple Ways to Trim Your Carbon Footprint. And Paul, you noted this isn't just about the food we take. This is about lifestyle choices. And I'm thinking about a specific week, this week in Cincinnati, for example, where we have really warm, lovely summer days. And then in the middle of it all, we get another revisit of winter. So people's thermostats are probably flying up and down with abandon. And this is something that you say we should be taking more control of.
Back up a second. The point of the climate diet was that, Americans emit something like 16 tons of carbon per person per year, which is more than any large industrialized country. So we really need to trim that. And when it comes to your thermostat, you might start to consider getting a programmable thermostat where you can actually punch in the numbers that is typical of your day. Now, you're probably going to miss some of those spikes when they, hit you, as you say, in the middle of a variable spring. But overall, if you can establish what your patterns are of needing heating and cooling, do a programmable thermostat. It's really not a very expensive thing to add to your home. Overall, you're going to save a significant amount of heating energy, and it's going to save you money. That's another point of this book, The Climate Diet, is that almost every single one of the 50 points in there will save you a little bit of money. So the point is not to burden you with a lot of extra cost, but actually to smartly guide you in a way that you can have your life be carbon lighter, but also a little cheaper.
One really interesting suggestion you have in here is that we shouldn't be so worried about stabilizing the American population. Maybe we should take a look at possibly reducing it?
Well, you know, you have to throw it out there, right? So, you know, as I said, 16 tons of CO2 per person per year in the United States. And by the way, if you compare that with France, which is only like 4 or 5 tons, which is much slimmer, you know, 1.5 tons per person from India. So, you know, we're really serious carbon burdens on the planet in the current American lifestyle. So, yes, I do make the suggestion that cutting back from 2 to 1 children, or I guess you really can't cut back a child, but, you know, for those young people who are interested in starting a family, people like yourself, single guys, you know, with lots of frozen food in your pantry, you know, I think we have this romanticized idea of the big, sprawling family, but keep in mind, each child is another 16 tons of carbon per person per year. And I do suggest in the book that there are other ways of kind of get your parenting fix. I interviewed a number of people who do a lot of mentoring. There are some people who do joint family raising. You know, I came across a couple, or two couples, two men living together and two women living together, and together they had 2 children. So 2 children raised among 4 parents. Now, I know that sounds kooky. I know your audience is going to say, whoa. But on the other hand, think about it, those people who are parents, think about it, the idea of being able to share parental responsibilities with another pair of parents, I mean, geez, that would have helped me quite a bit. You know, now that I have a 14-year-old on my hands, I could have used an extra couple of parents out there.
Well, Paul, I know I've only got you for about another minute, but you do connect the fight for racial justice to the fight for climate justice. Do you have a moment to explain that?
Well, yeah. You know, this is an all-hands-on-deck moment, and I should say that when I wrote this book, I really wrote it to appeal to both Democrats and Republicans, conservatives and liberals, as a way of getting everybody involved in the climate fight. As per racism, though, it's, you know, if you want to get everybody on deck, keeping a number of people not able to function in a politically active manner because they're too busy fighting racial oppression means that's a bunch more hands not on deck to help fight the climate fight. So I think trying to confront racism while we're confronting climate issues is really, really key, again, to get as many people fighting for as low a carbon footprint as possible and for a better future for everybody's children.
The name of the book is The Climate Diet, 50 Simple Ways to Trim Your Carbon Footprint. The author is Paul Greenberg. Paul, thanks so much for the time you gave us. We really appreciate it.
Thank you, Michael. I really appreciate it, too.
Recycling is also important, but it can also be confusing. There's a new book, Can I Recycle This? It tries to simplify all that for you. The author joins us next. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. Your local town here in our region more than likely has a recycling program, but all across the region, the rules can be different. That might leave us confused on what we can send off to a recycling facility. The new book, Can I Recycle This?, explains how such programs really work and offers insights and clarifications on the process so you can toss items in a green bin with more confidence that it's going to good reuse. The author of the book is Jenny Romer, who joins us now on Zoom. Jenny, welcome to our show.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
Well, it's a very informative book, and it's one that you start out with a phrase that we learned at a very young age, reduce, reuse, recycle. And you note, we seem only to remember the recycle part, but you argue the other two are more important. Can you tell us why?
Sure. If you're reducing or reusing, you're really avoiding the whole extraction and disposal process. That's really where a lot of the environmental harm comes in. But with recycling, you can avoid that, but it's not as guaranteed.
So what do you think we've done wrong in the messaging about this process, perhaps in our country, in our culture, where we've kind of lost the emphasis on reducing and reusing?
Well, I would say that it's not by accident. The plastics industry has spent a ton of money on lobbying and PR about recycling to make people feel to kind of lull people into a complacency that if they just put something in their recycling bin, that everything else is going to work. But that's not really the case. Only about 9% of plastic ever produced has been recycled. And a lot of the plastic that's being made right now isn't really recyclable.
And most of us participate in recycling programs through our city's curbside program. So we toss whatever we think is recyclable into these bins. What can you tell us about how right or wrong we are as we toss items basically with abandon? Do we need to be more aware about how we recycle?
Yeah, so I think that one big thing is to follow your local jurisdiction's rules about recycling. And so your jurisdiction has kind of figured out, based on what machinery they have, based on kind of how they, what they expect from their customers, what they will or won't accept. And what, so whether they've already decided whether they want to have a single stream, meaning everything is mixed together, or whether they want to have paper separated from metal, glass, and plastic. And they've decided whether they want to accept just certain types of plastic, or if they want to get everything and sort it out on their end. So follow those local rules. And then my book really gets into kind of what happens next. So recycling is a global commodities market. There's some materials that are worth a whole lot of money on that commodities market. There's some materials that are worth nothing. And so I'm looking at recycling as whether that material can be collected, sorted, and then sold to a manufacturer at the other end to actually get made into a new product.
I live in an apartment building, and we obviously have garbage cans, and then we have a couple of recycling bins. And sometimes I shake my head when I walk past the recycling bins, because it does seem that people just toss anything in there, and it's often running over with boxes that haven't been broken down, what looks like just trash they've discarded with a thought that perhaps it's going to be recycled. Is recycling more work than perhaps we're willing to accept in our everyday life? Do we need to put a little bit more effort into how we do it?
Yeah, I think we need to put more effort into how we do it. I think we also need to put more effort into what we're purchasing in the first place. And so one thing I want to get across is that there are certain products that you should try to avoid because they're not going to be recyclable. And I think that people also should know what they should be put, where they should be putting their efforts. So if something's not going to be recyclable, then, and if your city doesn't want to accept it, some people will kind of go to the opposite extreme and wash out every little thing really thoroughly. For example, coffee pods, those little single-use coffee pods for certain coffee makers. I know people who will clean out the coffee, take off the lids, and go out of their way to clean those. But those are really too small to make it through recycling machinery. And they're made of a resin that not a lot of companies want to buy. So not making that effort if something isn't going to be sold to a manufacturer. But it sounds like, you know, you have the opposite problem maybe where you are, where people aren't putting enough energy into sorting in the first place. But I think that a lot of people have become a little bit despondent about recycling more recently, hearing a lot of news that things aren't being recycled. And so one of my big take homes is that, no, there are, plastic isn't just one thing, and really making sure that people know that some plastic is really valuable and others aren't. So kind of where to put that energy.
We're talking with Jenny Romer, the author of the new book, Can I Recycle This? A Guide to Better Recycling and How to Reduce Single-Use Plastics. And Jenny, I just heard you use the term resin. This was a term that I wasn't familiar with before reading this book, but it does seem quite important. There's a term, resin identification code, which is assigned to plastics. Would you explain what that is to our listeners?
Sure. So at the bottom of plastic containers, there's generally a little chasing arrow symbol and then a number in the center. And so that number, there are six resins and then a seventh code that just means other. And so each of those six resins, that code is meant to make it easy for recyclers to distinguish what type of resin is being used. And each of those resins has different capabilities and has a different value on the commodities market. Generally, number one and number two plastic resin are the most valuable. Bottles and jugs made of number one and number two have the highest value. HDPE jugs, which are milk bottles, are worth about $1,000 a ton on the commodities market. Three through seven plastics, which is kind of a lot of the lower value stuff, is worth about -$20 on the commodities market, meaning that you have to pay someone to take it away. So that's a big difference. But the plastics industry really has done a lot of PR about recycling, and a lot of people think as long as they see that chasing arrow symbol, that packaging is recyclable, and that's really not the case.
That's what surprised me the most is, you know, you see those little chasing arrow symbol, the recycling symbol as we know it, and either we assume it means it's made from recycled material or it means we can just toss it in the bin when we're through with it. But we really need to be familiar with this term, it seems.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. And I think that's definitely a big take home is that people see that symbol and they feel obligated to put it in their bin, and they feel like that is actually going to be recycled. And there's so much more that happens after you put something in the bin. And there's a move even at the state level in some states, including California, to remove that the requirement, because there was lobbying that made it that required that symbol be used on plastic packaging. So there's a move now to make it so that symbol is not required, to maybe have a triangle or something else that isn't that Mobius loop, which is what the chasing arrow symbol is called. And because it makes people feel so much more comfortable about using plastic because they feel like it's going to be recycled with that when they see that chasing arrow symbol.
One will learn a lot by reading this book, a background on how the recycling system works. And the bulk of the book lays out individual items and explains why or why not these items can be recycled. And perhaps some of these items are more familiar to us as it relates to the debate on whether they should be used at all, how to reduce them, how you can recycle them. And you use a color-coded system, green, red, yellow, orange, colors that we're familiar with in terms of stop and go, for example. Straws are something that we're noticing a lot of attention on. Perhaps we go to a restaurant and if a straw is presented to us, it might be made out of paper. And I know that not everyone is thrilled with the functionality of paper straws, but how dangerous are we learning plastic straws are?
Yeah, plastic straws have really become symbolic, I think in part because of that turtle video. I don't know if you saw that, where a straw was stuck up a turtle's
yes.
nose. But they're similar to other utensils as far as recycling goes. So similar to forks and plastic forks and spoons, straws are kind of awkwardly shaped. They're usually made out of number 6, maybe number 5 resin. And so they have a problem that they are really, they're probably not going to be sorted at the recycling facility. They're too kind of small and awkwardly shaped. They're not going to make it through all the conveyor belts and things. And then at the other end, even if they happen to make it into a bale, which is unlikely, because they're made of that lower value resin, the number 5 or number 6 resin, no one's going to want to buy them. So they're a big problem as far as not really being recyclable. But so many people will, you know, order food or get takeout food, get that extra bit of utensils or straws, and then put them in the recycling bin thinking, oh, it doesn't really matter, I'll just recycle it. But those aren't actually being recycled. They're either going to landfill, incinerated, or maybe shipped abroad. So that's one thing that could easily be avoided. A lot of states now have, particularly for straws, have straws upon request laws that just make it so people have to ask if they want a straw. And with takeout and delivery, trying to make clear to the restaurant that you're ordering from or picking up from that you don't need a utensils or a straw, especially if you're going home.
You touched on something that I was going to go to next, and that's other food-related items. And I'm thinking during this pandemic how significant takeout had become as we try to support restaurants since we couldn't eat inside of them for so long. And a lot of delivery apps are out there making a lot of trips for people bringing us food. And plastic takeout food containers, not recyclable, according to your book. Coated paper takeout food containers, not recyclable. It sounds like a lot of the stuff we're getting delivered to us, especially if it comes in certain packaging, it cannot be recycled. It's just trash.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that makes a lot of people very sad because I think people spend so much time kind of cleaning out their food containers. And you know, a lot of people, we have a lot less choices during the pandemic as far as a lot of restaurants are only doing takeout and delivery. And so if you want to order food or to order food from a restaurant, it's going to come in that packaging. One thing that we're working on is I'm an attorney with the Surfrider Foundation, and we have an ocean-friendly restaurants program, and we're really, really trying to encourage restaurants to switch to reuse systems. So having a reusable container that you can get from a restaurant and return when you're done. But then there are a lot of pilot projects happening with that. But in the meantime, so much of that food, so the food containers are not recyclable. But I will say that there's some chance of certain food containers being recycled. So one thing they talk about is PET. So if you get a clamshell container with it, maybe with a salad in it, that usually is made from either number one PET plastic resin or number six polystyrene. The polystyrene's, like I said, low value resin, never going to be recycled really in the US. But the PET has some chance, if it's mixed in with some bottles and jugs, it might get recycled in the commodities market. So it's complicated, but for the most part, most of that stuff is not getting recycled. Some of it might be getting composted if you live in a place with commercial composting, but even then, a lot of commercial composters don't want a whole lot of foodware. They probably prefer plastic or paper foodware to plastic. But you know, as we're emerging from this pandemic, really seeing more dine-in meals and particularly having dine-in meals be on reusables, be on real plates with real forks, metal forks, ceramic plates, versus even sometimes in restaurants when you're sitting down, you'll get that single-use packaging. So it's really trying to reduce that at the source as well.
We're talking with Ginny Romer, the author of the new book, Can I Recycle This? A Guide to Better Recycling and How to Reduce Single-Use Plastics. It features illustrations by Christy Young. You mentioned the single-use coffee pods and how they would be challenging to recycle. And it makes me think of coffee. And you do explore foam coffee cups, for example. And I think a lot of us are more familiar that foam is not something that we can recycle. I was surprised to read that paper coffee cups are also not recyclable.
Yeah, I'm sorry to be a bit of a downer. but again, you know, I've been on a lot of recycling tours. I love to, you know, watch them online or, you know, before the pandemic, going on a lot of municipal recycling tours. And I've been to a few paper mills. And really, the whole paper milling process, recycling process, is taking all the paper and putting it into kind of a big steamy cauldron of hot water. And that's exactly what paper cups are meant to withstand. So paper cups are made from short paper fibers. They have a coating on them to withstand the hot water. And so they really have a hard time making it through paper pulping facilities. And those short fibers really kind of go through the screens. It's kind of, that makes it really hard to get anything out of a paper cup to recycle. And then those lids are generally made out of resin number six, which no one wants to buy. So, you know, I say all of this to say, you know, really hopefully inspire people to bring their own coffee cups, because right now a lot of people have at least a cup of coffee a day. And that adds up to a whole lot of coffee cups.
So there is a type of food product that is delivered that we can recycle, and those are those pizza boxes. Do we need to do anything to them before we toss them in the recycling?
Yeah, so I have a nice little illustration of how much grease can you have in your pizza box. It depends on where you are, but for the most part, I'd say no grease. So if you have a lining that protected your box from the pizza grease, then you can probably recycle the whole thing. If you've gotten grease on your box, then maybe just ripping off the top and only recycling the top. But that's one of the illustrations I really like.
Yeah, there are a lot of very helpful illustrations in this. As we start to wrap up, though, let me be selfish. I'm about to do some spring cleaning. I get the New Yorker at home, a lovely magazine with beautiful covers, and it's hard for me to part with it. So I just put it in this decorative box. I need to get rid of them. Should they go in the recycling bin or should they go in the trash?
Well, I would hold on to them for a while, but yeah, magazines are very recyclable. So you can go ahead and put the magazines into your recycling bin in most jurisdictions.
The book is called Can I Recycle This? A Guide to Better Recycling and How to Reduce Single-Use Plastics. The author is Ginny Romer, who has been our guest via Zoom today. Ginny, thank you so much for letting us read the book in advance, and thank you for joining us today. We appreciate the time.
Yeah, thanks so much.
And up next, buying a refurbished computer isn't just good for your wallet, apparently. It could also be good for the environment. The leader of one local organization explains that position next. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. And this is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. As you contemplate how to be a better steward of the Earth on this Earth Day, when it's time to get a new computer, for example, there's a couple of things you can do. One local organization says, don't throw the old one out necessarily. You can send it off to be recycled or refurbished. And then you can buy a refurbished one for yourself. Joining us now is the executive director of the Cincinnati Computer Cooperative, Frank Adams. Frank, welcome to the show.
Happy to be here, Michael.
So listen, I understand that the Cincinnati Computer Cooperative, which engages a lot of reuse related to electronic devices, has been quite busy during the COVID-19 pandemic. And you've been busy even when you couldn't have your volunteers there, something we're familiar with here at Cincinnati Public Radio. Talk about why you've been maybe busier than usual during the pandemic.
Oh, yeah. In the early phase of the pandemic, the sales were up 60%. We had a lot of people coming in who were shifting jobs and needed to work from home and didn't have a computer, and we have very affordable ones for them. Plus, there was a big influx of students who needed computers. I mean, even though the school district said, you know, they would get everybody a laptop of some type, that took some time, and we filled the gap there.
What's the experience like for people in that position who are like, look, you know, we're transitioning to this virtual lifestyle. We need access to this thing, but we're on a tight budget. What is the advantage of going to an organization like yours when searching for something?
Well, okay, we cater to specific populations. We have an agreement with Microsoft that allows us to get licenses to refurbish computers. But those licenses are restricted in that they have to be used for some sort of social benefit. So our customers, our clients are either on some form of public assistance, like unemployment, for example, are students of any age, so we'll take students from kindergarten through postgrad, and for senior citizens, people over 55, as well as other nonprofits. And now the advantage of going to us is that they can get a very good functional computer for as little as $150. And it comes complete with genuine Microsoft software. So they have both Windows 10 and Office, now Office 2019 on them. So Word, Excel, PowerPoint. So any productivity software most people need. And it's very affordable. And plus, it's also ecologically very sound because that's a computer then that isn't going to be either recycled or put into the landfill.
So your organization typically has volunteers that are there helping to maybe repair or to refurbish these electronic devices. And I guess during the pandemic, when we all needed to be distanced, you weren't able to do that. So it changed the way you accept contributions and donated devices.
That's correct. Right now, we're just basically taking donations from businesses because the business computers are usually much higher quality than you would get from your average, you know, home computer. The average person who brings in their home computer has, like, taken it out of service maybe 5-10 years ago and put it in a closet someplace before they decide to bring it in and recycle it. And most of that's all of that stuff went to scrap. And that's primarily what the volunteers did, was sort all of that stuff in the right categories, or remove the hard drive so we could erase them all. And like I said, sort it in the various categories, and then we would send a truck up to Cohen Recycling about every 3 weeks or so. And that's about 12,000 pounds of stuff.
So how were you able to adjust? Are you doing this primarily on your own at this point?
Yeah, well, we have four employees now. And and the employees really can take up all the slack on the refurbishing end of it. But the recycling is too labor intensive. So we've really cut back on accepting individual donations. And just focused on the refurbishing end of it.
We're talking with Frank Adams. He's the executive director of the Cincinnati Computer Cooperative. Frank, who are you? How did this organization come into being?
Well, it got started by a group of people back in 2002, and I wasn't around then, but they were in another refurbishing nonprofit that they felt like they could do better, and they went off and started their own. And at that time, it was all volunteer. And then in 2004, we finally got our 501(c) and rented some warehouse space in Woodlawn. We've got like 12,000 square feet of warehouse. And and that just started 2 days a week, basically. Volunteers would come in and accept computers and sell some. And that just advanced from there, and then they started taking on employees. I joined back in, I want to say 2008, as a volunteer. And then I got on the board and then was chairman of the board and then treasurer. And we kept going. And then I came on, we lost our one employee and there was nobody to replace them. So I sold my business and came in and took over leading the place, basically.
Okay. And for people who are listening and hearing, you know, that you're not taking individual contributions, just business contributions right now, and they're looking around their home like, oh, I've got a, you know, an old iPad, or I've got an old laptop, I've got an old desktop computer. If we can't take it to you at Cincinnati Computer Cooperative right now, do you have a recommendation on where people should go if they do want to recycle the materials?
Cohen Recycling, they have a very large wing that specializes in electronics. They have a huge facility up in Middletown, and that is one of the main things they do there. And so either take it to Cohen Recycling, or you can take it. I think Best Buy still accepts old electronics, and Staples will as well.
When you think about the nearly 20 years that the Cincinnati Computer Cooperative has been in existence, and we think about, you know, Earth Day, what has the impact been?
Well, one estimate says we've kept maybe 4 million pounds of electronic waste out of landfills. Nothing that goes through there. Well, none of the electronics, anyhow, ends up in the landfill. And we've made more than 10,000 computer systems available to local residents. I mean, that we've actually placed with them. We've given away, in conjunction with Cranston Computers, about 1,000 systems to area teachers for free for them to use in the classroom. And that's been the impact.
I read a report from the National Resources Defense Council, the NRDC, that discarded electronics in 2019 weighed as much as 350 Queen Mary II ocean liners, and that last year we produced more than 16 pounds of e-waste, as it's called, for every one of the billions of people who live on the planet. So what are the consequences of these types of materials going into landfills?
Well, they contain a lot of toxic elements that really just aren't good to leach out in the groundwater. We've got mercury, beryllium, lead, cadmium, arsenic, and then in the plastics, and a lot of them there have some brominated flame retardants. So, and those are all things that shouldn't end up in the groundwater, end up in a landfill. And they can be handled responsibly through recyclers who specialize in decommissioning electronics.
You know, one of the things about the consumer electronics market in this country is people who are really into it like to stay up to date on what's new and when can they get the newest gadget. But Frank, you and the Cincinnati Computer Cooperative suggest that it's worthwhile for sustainability purposes to explore purchasing a refurbished computer instead. So if I am somebody who wants a powerful machine, who wants something with new options on it, How would you convince me that your suggestion is the right way to go?
It depends on what you want to do. I mean, most people don't need all of that, you know, the fastest processor. And I don't know. Our computers, you can get a good 5 years out of them. And for most day-to-day activities, they're just more than adequate. And we have some more expensive laptops that are a bit faster. And some more expensive desktops that are a bit faster. But, yeah, no, they're able to do almost any heavy lifting that you need. I mean, if you need to, like, edit commercial video or something like that, then maybe you would need the newest. But for most tasks that people do, they really don't need that much computing power.
So if it's somebody who's just, you know, they're typing up documents, they're maybe doing some work, maybe they're having Zoom meetings and they definitely need a strong internet connection, you are able to accommodate those types of consumers?
Yes, yes.
And so what has your business been like? We talked a little bit on the volunteer side of things and how you've been able to assist people in need, and that is your target market. But, you know, just the average professional, have you seen an increase in those visits as well?
Some, but then again, they have to either be like senior citizen or on unemployment or something. You know, they have to qualify in order to buy a computer from us.
We're talking to Frank Adams. He is the executive director of the Cincinnati Computer Cooperative. What happens when a computer is dropped off? What's the process? How does it, what all does it go through with the, I guess in better times, you know, when you're able to have the volunteers in there, let's talk a little bit about the process and what ends up happening to a machine that's dropped off.
Well, even now, it still happens with the machines, say, we get from a business. The first thing we do is take out all the hard drives or the whatever storage they have and erase it irrevocably so that there's no trace of data left on that machine. They get inspected. We have a checklist with about 30 different things that we test out on every machine to make sure that they're in good working order. Then they put a clean drive back into them, and then we re-image them with Windows 10 and Office and a couple other programs as well. And they get thoroughly cleaned and put out for sale.
And again, I understand that 530 pounds of fossil fuels can be saved here if you buy a pre-owned laptop and you're saving a little bit of money by buying a pre-owned laptop. How do you calculate these numbers that were provided, 530 pounds of fossil fuel, if we take the pre-owned route?
It's actually probably more if you take the pre-owned route. The 531 pounds of fossil fuel come from, that's what it takes to build a new computer, and along with a lot of water and other resources. And when you recycle it, for every ton of computers that get recycled, right, ground up and the metals extracted from them, that saves about 1.5 tons of carbon emissions. So, I've heard the figure kicked around that it's like 25 times more efficient just to keep reusing it and to extend the life of it so that you don't need to replace it then with a new computer.
I also saw some information provided that the 2018 Hamilton County Waste Composition Study, where researchers there take samples, sort them, and then determine the composition of the waste stream, they found that 1.9% of the waste stream in Hamilton County overall and 1% in the city of Cincinnati proper is electronic waste. So what does that exactly mean to us? 1.9% sounds like a low number, but is that significant as it relates to electronic waste?
Yeah, we submit to that survey every year. And that number is low. If you read the study closely, they don't even mention computers and electronics. They talk about stereos and radios and things like that. But yeah, I think that is low. I mean, if you use the 1.9 figure, it comes out to be about 17,000 tons. And they figure of that, and they figure also that maybe 536 tons were actually recycled, so went off to a processor to be recycled.
Obviously, we are device heavy these days. You know, we might have a desktop, we might have a laptop, we might have a tablet, we might have some sort of reading device like a Kindle brand piece of equipment, a mobile phone, of course, maybe multiple mobile phones. So is the increase in our use of electronic devices and the way we dispose of them, does that have a bigger threat for us down the road as we accumulate more of these items?
Yes, it does. And also there's planned obsolescence. I mean, the manufacturers, Apple especially, builds their devices so that, you know, after so many years, you want a new one. I don't know. According to the EPA, like for every million cell phones that are recycled, you recover 35,000 pounds of copper, 772 pounds of lead, rather silver, and 70 pounds of gold, along with 33 pounds of palladium. And all those minerals are resource intensive to mine. And so by recycling them, you at least save energy on the production of those, and you can use those metals again in new devices.
All right, Frank, I know that you said that you're down to just your employees, no volunteers right now, but very quickly, let us know, what's your timeline, do you think, when you'll be back to what we might call normal?
I think actually with the just employees, it works pretty well like that.
All right. Well, hopefully, you know, we'll get to see you in person soon. We do appreciate the time that you spent with us today, and we wish you luck there. This is Frank Adams, the executive director of the Cincinnati Computer Cooperative. Frank, thanks for the time you gave us. Happy Earth Day to you.
Happy Earth Day. Thank you very much.
And you've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Our producer is Selena Reeder. Our technical director is Josh Elstro. Our assistant producer is Nick Swartzel. Archives online at WVXU.org. I'm Michael Monks. We'll talk again tomorrow.